Hello, and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast from CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady, and this is podcast number 257. So the Manwood game is done and dusted. 3-2, we were a much better team. They get a 95th minute goal, and that obviously caused some disappointment. But if someone had said to me at the beginning of the Champions League qualifying, we will go into the final game knowing if we don't lose, we're through, I'd have taken that. And that's exactly the position we're in. So next week, here we go for the Champions League. Straight after the game, came home with my cup of tea. I had a podcast with two guys who don't know anything about football whatsoever. So it was quite good that I knew I was rising early the next morning to have a podcast with a football expert, and that's Mr. Derek Gray, the BT Sport commentator, previously of ESPN and other channels. For those of you not old enough to remember, Derek actually made his name for BBC Radio Scotland as a very, very young man, and left these cold shores to really establish his career as a leading commentator for some of the biggest names in broadcasting across in the United States. Derek was very generous to give me just over an hour of his time. We talked about lots of things to do with his career. We started with the Mamo game the night before and then progressed on from there. I hope you enjoy the podcast, and at the other end, I will be press ganging all of you to take part in the annual John Thompson Memorial cycle from Cardenden. Oh, and also, don't forget the Dunfermline Celtic Legends Jockstein Memorial game at East End Park. But enough from me. This is me, Harry Brady, with him, Mr. Derek Ray. Every time that flag's unfurled, they come into America. Got a dream to take them there. So I'm joined by Derek Ray. Thanks very much for joining us. There are a set number of questions we normally ask someone when they join when they come on the Celtic Underground podcast about their first game, first heroes, etc. However, this is the morning after the night before, where Celtic won a game and it felt like a defeat, and you were commentating on that in the gantry at Celtic Park. You have the benefit of what I don't have at the game, which is you have the replays to be able to analyse who mucked up for the goals. So Derek Ray, give me your impressions of last night.
Well, I think, first of all, it was a great occasion. Let's say that. I think you've got to look at these things from a neutral point of view. And I was working last night, as we were speaking now, with a lot of people who come up from London for BT Sport. And it was their first taste of Celtic Park. It was their first experience of that sort of event. And you know, they came away thinking, my goodness, you know, what a place, what a stadium, what fans these are. Are they like this every game?
Yeah.
And so I think sometimes, you know, we take that for granted a little bit, and it's special as a commentator as well to be part of a night like that. But then when you look at the game, I feel a bit like you do, and I think probably most Celtic fans. You know, I'm a Scottish football fan.
Yeah.
My job is to be a commentator, to try to play it down the middle, but obviously we're covering Celtic because there's a lot of interest in Celtic. They're a Scottish team in Europe, and BT Sport is the rights-holding channel for the UK, and so we're going to look at things from a Celtic angle without being overly partisan. I think Celtic played well for most of the game. I think first half especially. I think mistakes crept in after the break. And then you look at the last one, and you would say that was a very bad goal to give away. And there were a number of culpable players on it. Yeah. I mean, I think you could probably name Boyata, you could name Ambrose, you could look at the players and their system of marking at mm-hmm. The goal that was scored by Berger, his second goal. But overall, I'm sort of trying to look at the positive, and I always do that. And it's a one-goal lead that Celtic have yeah. going to Sweden. Now, I'm not saying that that would have been perfect before a ball was kicked, but I think there are probably some Celtic supporters out there who, before the game started, might have thought 3-2 would be okay. Mm-hmm. Certainly better than 3-2 the other way.
Yeah, so, I mean, as a fan, you're always looking at who's made the mistakes, and it was just frustrating that we are in the final seconds
yeah.
of injury time, and you think, can we not just clear a corner? That's
yeah.
I don't know. My recollection is we were too busy mucking about at the corner flag to try and put them off without concentrating on our own game, and then there was too many bodies inside the 6-yard box that actually got in each other's way.
So. I think that was part of it. The other thing too, and I think this maybe put everybody off, was that little silly spat between the Peruvian Jotun and yeah. Johansson. And I'm still not sure that Johansson did very much wrong at all, but they both got shown the yellow card.
I thought Johansson and Brown both got yellow cards last night for the thing particularly foreign referees yeah. do. When there's a bit of a scrap, I'm going to call you both over and just book both of you.
Yeah, and it did happen on a couple of occasions in that game. But, you know, as a production team, we're looking at these things too, and it'd be quite interesting, I think, for a viewer sometime to have the headphones on and hear what's being said yeah. you know, during a game, because we have our own little team routine as well, and it all happens in a blink of an eye. It all happens so quickly. And that was the thing, first of all, we were trying to get the yellow card covered, because an important thing, because these pictures are going around the world, it's not just for the UK audience. Yeah. We're responsible for the pictures that go around the world. And Grant Phillips, who's the Scottish director, does all our games here in Scotland, was the director last night. So he's also conscious of trying to get the technical side of, right, yellow card, get that shown, and then be ready for the corner. But it all seemed to happen so quickly. And then seconds later, I was saying, Berger has done it again. He's come back to haunt Celtic again. So, it wasn't the ideal ending from the Celtic point of view.
I suppose from our point of view, though, we were 3-2 down to Inter Milan and scored a last-minute goal. The amount of number of last-minute goals yeah. Celtic have scored in European football, once in a blue moon, one will come back and bite us. So,
yeah, and Ronnie Dyla said that afterwards. I mean, late goals happen, and mm-hmm. they happen for both sides. And in this case, It's a hard thing to digest, isn't it? It's, you know, I use the phrase with the rain teeming down, you know, that damp squib feeling that, yeah. that everybody had at the end of it, because I think 3-1, and I said this in commentary, the difference between 3-1 and 3-2 psychologically is huge. You know, it's just one goal, but it feels like two or three goals.
It's a very simple fact of going into the last minute of injury time in Malmo at 0-0.
Yeah.
We're through, because they're not going to score two goals in a minute. Going through to, yeah. and we could be out because somebody takes a shot from 40 yards, it cannons off somebody's heel, balloons right. into the top corner, and you're out.
Yeah.
That's the massive difference.
And I think the other thing, you know, just talking off the cuff here, the other thing, the more you consider the Celtic selection for the second leg, Lustig being out, which you yeah. know, seems to be a certainty. Lustig being out is a big blow, because yeah. I think he's one of Celtic's better players. I think he's a calm footballer, and it's probably going to be F.A. Ambrose. It might be Sadie Yanko. I would think it probably would be Ambrose. And again, there's a difference there in the mm-hmm. quality. So Celtic are going to have to be at their absolute best. It's going to be fascinating to watch them.
So how do you prepare for a game like that in terms of getting knowledge? One of the reasons why European football is so uncertain mm. is because we as supporters don't know much about the opposition. Mm. And what you do garner, well, they won 5-0 on Saturday, but we've no idea whether that 5-0 was the equivalent of Celtic beating Alloa 5-0 or Celtic beating Aberdeen 5-0. So how do you prepare for a game?
I've got my routine, and it involves several days of video watching. That's something you can do now in a way that you couldn't several yep. years ago. I mean, I can remember my early days as a commentator, which we'll maybe get to in yeah. the discussion later. You know, there's no internet, there were no technological resources. It was maybe a phone call to somebody who you knew, a journalist, or another commentator who might give you some very rudimentary information about the players. Now everything's out there, and one of the things that there's a passion of mine is linguistics, if you like. So mm-hmm. I speak a few languages, and I like to use that to my advantage a little bit. Now, I don't speak Swedish, but thankfully the Swedish journalists all speak very good English. But French, German, Spanish, I can turn my hand to. So that does come in handy. But it's over several days, and I would show you my bag's just over there as we speak now, and it's got all my team sheets. I've kept all my team sheets going back over years and years and years. And in fact, we'll just... I know this is radio or podcast, but I'm going to show you one because you'll probably be absolutely terrified by this. I put this on Twitter quite recently.
Yes, I did see that, and
you've got it in your hands now.
Yeah,
so.
And I do have it in my hands, and just to let people know, I don't need glasses. Although I am beginning, with the use of mobile phones, I am beginning to think I start to need things, and I'm not quite sure what distance this needs to be from my eyes to be able to pick it up. I think probably better would be if I took a photograph of that, put it on an iPad, and then tried to blow it up is the only way I could.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. It's basically one sheet of paper.
How can you write that small?
I don't know. It's one of these things I developed years ago, and I'll tell you how these things start. And I think you'll see this kind of thing from people of my generation.
Well, I was going to say, do you think your methodology is now your own? In terms of you talked about you know watching on video, and you've got this combination of a mixture of the old-fashioned way and the new way. It's very much your own. Was this taught to you as someone as to how to do it?
No, that totally evolved. Essentially, in my early days, you had
just to give some context, you could fit a full description of Logan Bailey on the back of a postage stamp the size of writing the Derek Race here, and I'm not exaggerating, so carry on.
No, well, in the early days, of course, you were commentating from very, very tight, not really gantries, they were just the backs of stands, so you had no elbow room, so you had to devise a system whereby you could fit your notes onto your lap. So that's where this came from. I thought, well, you know what, the only way to do this properly is to have everything on one sheet of paper. Now, my language studies also played a part in this, because I realised quite early on that the way that you remember things, and you have to do that as a language student, the way you remember things is to write them down. So writing down, colour coding became part of it as well. And it was interesting, a psychology student friend of mine when I was at university said, you do realise that about 80% of us learn by having a photographic memory. There's about 20% who don't memorize in a different way. But most of us, if we write something down, whether we know it or not, we do subconsciously remember where on the page we wrote it down.
Yep.
And I find that's true of myself. So that if I've done, like, for example, we've got the Celtic team here, we've got some notes I've made about Celtic. If I made a little note about Stuart Armstrong having not scored in 20 matches until he netted a brace at the weekend against Inverness, I'll remember where I put that on the page, and it'll stay with me for some reason. But if it doesn't stay with me, then I remember where on the page it is.
Yeah.
So I know it's anorak behaviour, as somebody might say here, but it's a necessary part of the.
No, it's fascinating, and it is one of those things of I've written out some points to discuss with you today.
Yeah.
The fact that I've written them down, I probably won't need to read them. I remember them, but if I'm
that's
not...
It.
Yeah, so, so if we take you back, we've talked about it last night, so if you take you back, I mentioned I was on the... I was recording the At By The Men Celtic podcast last night, and I mentioned to Lawrence Donegan that we were speaking, and Lawrence said, oh, Derek was quite a child prodigy. and you were. You were doing radio commentary, hospital radio commentary from 15...
Yep.
BBC Radio Scotland at 19, and award-winning radio journalist at 20.
Yeah, that's right.
So it's. Do you want to talk us through how? Because somebody listening to this, one of the glories of modern technology and the internet is it's no longer one of. Sorry to bounce around. I would suggest not to blow smoke. I would suggest one of the reasons you're liked by such a cross-section of supporters is when I grew up, the analysis on football was the score 1-0, 2-0 or 3-0. And football supporters get into the nth degree detail about discussing a game in the pub for 2 hours beforehand, yet so much football coverage is superficial, whereas people like yourselves and one or two others in the media now do get into the level of detail the supporters want to talk about and have an understanding, and don't just say things like, ho, 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 coefficients, you need to be a Cambridge University lecturer to understand that. No, you don't. No. You just need to know your job.
Right.
One of the things about you is that seems to garner respect, your point about being a reporter on Scottish football, so an advocate of Scottish football, seems to be one of the points, but also because you know your stuff. So a lot of people listening to this might be in the same boat. They're not going to make it playing football. I realised when the Celtic manager was younger than me that I was not going to make it playing for Celtic. That was the dawning light. So how did you get into the radio?
Well, it was probably similar when you think about what you've just said there. I knew fairly early on I was going to make it as a footballer. I played enthusiastically, played in the playground, played at school, played with friends, all that sort of thing. But at the age of seven, 1974 World Cup, something happened. I became completely obsessed with that tournament. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, I was off school at the time. I was at, I would have been going to Airy Hall Primary School in Aberdeen. And I must have watched every game in that World Cup. I'm trying to think now. So I would actually have been on holiday at that point. I probably wouldn't have been on holiday because it was June and July. But I think in those days, ITV used to replay the games during the day. They had this thing called the morning match. And I think you'd often see that over breakfast. It was before
Most of the games tend to be when you finish school. There's a game there and then there's a game.
So we were home in time to see it. But I remember watching just about every game. And there's actually a tape that my father still has in the loft in our house in Aberdeen. And it's a tape of me with a voice that's much higher than the one that you're hearing now, essentially commentating on all these games and also impersonating all the pundits. Mm-hmm. So I've kept that tape because it's still quite funny to, I haven't heard it for years, but it's funny to bring out now and again. So something happened to me in 1974. I was already, you know, football daft. I would go to football with my dad. It was Aberdeen, obviously, the local team. And it sort of just kicked on from there. And David Francie became my great hero. Yeah. I used to listen to David. People of my generation will certainly remember David very fondly. And so I kept doing this, you know, making these tapes and, you know, studying the whole commentary art. And at the age of 12, I suddenly plucked up the courage to take my tape recorder with me to reserve matches at Pittodrie.
Yeah.
I'm sure the people around me thought, who is this young nutter who is sitting on his own here with a tape recorder talking to himself? But I would do this, you know, joyfully, and I would listen to it back afterwards and think, okay, I could have done that better. Oh, that was quite good. Oh, well, that there's room for improvement there. And I thought, well, you know, I really enjoy listening to David Francie, so why don't I try and send him a tape and see what he thinks of this? Mm-hmm. So I did, thinking, well, it'll never get to him, and even if it does, he'll be far too busy. But 2 weeks later, I got this beautiful handwritten letter that I've kept to this day from the great man himself. Mm-hmm. It was home address in Newton Mearns. I'll never forget that. And it was, say, a wonderful letter, essentially encouraging me, saying, really enjoyed the commentary. Here are a couple of things I work on, you know, some vocal techniques and things I use with my commentary. Really wish you the best of luck. If you ever see me at Pittodrie, make yourself known to me and we'll have a chat. So we did that. We kept in touch over a number of years. And so I kept doing the commentaries, eventually gravitated to hospital radio in Aberdeen, which is you know, a common thing for a lot of broadcasters. So many people you'll bump into in broadcasting will say they got their first start at hospital radio. And of course, I was lucky enough to be working as a volunteer for hospital radio doing the commentary at a time when Aberdeen were very much in the ascendant. Yeah. It was the Alex Ferguson years. It was that European run, which saw them win the Cup Winners' Cup in 1983. It's amazing to think about it now. And I learned so much during that period. So that was really the formative period. And went to university at the age of 18, sent another tape off to David Francie. This time, he was a bit crafty. He passed it on to his bosses at the BBC.
Right.
And I got a letter back from them saying, David Francie has done this. We really like your stuff. Can you come down to Glasgow and have a chat? And from there, it really gathered pace. I was asked to first of all report on a couple of games. Then I got my first commentary, which was Kilmarnock against Dumbarton in the second tier, as it was.
I was trying to look that up. Yeah. And 1986, Kilmarnock-Dumbarton.
Yep.
The fortunate thing, actually, Kilmarnock and Dumbarton played each other quite a few times in 1986, so I couldn't pinpoint what game it was. Every one of them had goals in them.
Yep,
that's so right. What was the score? What was the game?
It was Kilmarnock 3, Dumbarton 0, as right. I remember. Yep. And it was April 1986. And the thing about it was, I did that commentary in isolation thinking, well, you know, I'm getting my chance on a second-tier game. David was injured, actually, had a knee injury.
Yep.
And Jerry McNee, who would often do commentaries around that time as well, he couldn't do it. He had other commitments. And Roddy Forsyth, another colleague who's still with Five Live, yep. Roddy had just had his jags for Mexico for the World Cup done, mm-hmm. so he was at no fit state to do the game. So I got my chance. I thought, as I say, this is it, the one-off opportunity. You know, it might be years before I get this chance again. But lo and behold, I arrived back in Aberdeen, 7 o'clock at night, and my father said, Charles Runcie called. Charles Runcie was the producer at mm-hmm. BBC, just wanted to have a chat with you. And I thought, okay, well, I hope he was happy.
Yeah.
So
I suppose you must have had mixed emotions of, is he phoning up to say, what were you doing?
Yeah.
Or is he phoning up to say, that was great?
Well, that's right, exactly. You never quite know. But what he said was, really well done. Everybody really enjoyed your commentary. And by the way, would you fancy doing the England-Scotland match at Wembley for mm-hmm. us on Wednesday night?
Yeah.
So that was... As a youngster, you sort of think...
From Kilmarnock to Barton.
Yeah, to England-Scotland.
Yeah.
I mean, it truly was a remarkable week. And so I did that, went down to Wembley, and never forget it. John Gregg was my co-commentator. Mike Ingham, great broadcaster, was mm-hmm. my fellow commentator. It was a split commentary in those days. You would do 22 and a half minutes and then pass over to the other commentator, which is quite nice, I think. It's a different way of doing it, and you don't hear of it so much now. But it was very much in vogue back then. And... So kept up until the end of that season doing games for Radio Scotland. Actually, the biggest one thereafter, and you'll remember this fondly, was the last day of that league season, which was when Hearts went to Dundee.
Yeah.
I happened to be at the Love Street end of it doing St Mirren Celtic.
Yeah.
And I was there just because they said, we want to put you there because... You know, obviously Hearts are the favourites going in here, but the story might switch and we want somebody there who can mm-hmm. commentate. And so I got that story. And I will admit that part of me still feels very sorry for Hearts because, mm-hmm. you know, they've been starved of success. And I do like the underdog as well. But I also recognise that as a commentator, I ended up sort of being in the right place where
that was the story.
Yeah.
I mean, to this day, my first Celtic game was October 74. And to this day... The best Celtic goal I've ever seen is the third goal in that game.
Yeah, well, that's right. And everybody raves about that. I can still picture that goal. I remember interviewing David Hay afterwards, the Celtic manager, and you could see that that goal meant an awful lot to him. And it was a great Celtic performance. You know, Hearts obviously were the team that everybody was talking about, but Celtic did the job on the day.
I do. Being a football fan, it's difficult to have sympathy. I empathise with the Hearts fans because... Well, here we are. It's going to be 30 years later.
I know.
And really can envisage another opportunity for... So, you know, you're already looking at Hearts fans mid-40s being the youngest people to be able to recall how great that season was for them. So I do have a bit of an empathy, but...
But you're a Celtic fan and,
yes,
you know, and you revel
still to this day,
in triumphs like that.
So, which actually then gets me to touch on, I'll bring a question forward that I was going to ask you. That type of event of you go along to that game, you know there's a possibility that if that game does become a story, it is a massive story.
Yes.
What would be the most memorable games that you've commentated on? It was going to be a much later question, but since we're talking of that game, what was your most memorable?
The one that absolutely stands out, and I think this will be very hard to top, would be the 2005 Champions League final
mm-hmm.
in Istanbul.
Yeah,
I'd never been there before. I was based in the States at the time with ESPN. Made this long journey several days ahead of the final because ESPN had all this programming, this extra programming they wanted to do from the Blue Mosque and the Hagia Sophia Mosque, and just to get a flavour of Istanbul. AC Milan against Liverpool.
Yeah.
And went there thinking this could be a good final. Milan are probably favourites. Saw a lot of AC Milan at that time. Maldini was still playing for them. Crespo, Inzaghi, all the rest of them. And it was 3-0 to Milan after 40-odd minutes. And I looked over to my producer at halftime and I said, we've come all this way and we've got a dud final. We've got a final that's got no suspense whatsoever. Well, what did I know?
Yeah.
The second half, Liverpool came storming back, but Steven Gerrard got a goal first of all. We thought, well, that's probably just a consolation goal. It'll sting Milan into action again, but not a bit of it. Before you knew it, it was 3-3, and they were playing extra time, and it went to penalties, and Liverpool completed the greatest comeback ever in a European final. And I think that, just for sheer drama, I think the backdrop was part of it too, because I'm a big fan of the venue and the place, you know, this whole sense of place thing, I think is important. And to bring that home from this faraway venue, remember, this is to American viewers and Australian viewers and, you know, viewers in all parts of the world, you know, to be in this exotic place, Istanbul, you know, by the Bosphorus, and with its unique architecture and culture, and have Liverpool, you know, doing this, which was so unexpected. And I like to think that the commentary matched the occasion. A lot of Liverpool fans have been in touch, you know, over the years, saying, you know, that was one of their favourite commentaries, and it means, you know, it means a lot when somebody says that, because you put your heart and soul into it. And as a commentator, you are reacting to events. You are dependent on what material the players give you. You work harder when there's not a lot of material, but you're at your best, I always think, when you're simply reacting to what's in front of you and finding the words, finding words that complement what's happening. And I think that will probably always be my favourite, because it's so rare to get a major final like that and have it pan out the way it did.
But your point, to talk about your job in the commentary, as a football fan, when you're at a game, I talked about the game against Inter Milan last season, for example. When you're at the game, you actually do want to come back and immediately relive that defining moment of the game. And actually, the commentary that you then listen to, because it's a bit like reading a book and somebody turns it into a film. If they cast the actor wrongly, they've completely ruined both the film and the book for you. And so your memory of that game actually starts to evolve into being the memory of the television commentary as much as the event when you were there. And if the commentator helps to encapsulate the emotion that everybody in that stadium felt at the right time, then that can be a priceless commentary to watch over and over again. Equally, if they get it not right, then it just doesn't sit comfortably. So it is a big task, and to have Liverpool fans give that compliment for a game which 10 years on for them is still probably the greatest thing that they've done in the last 20 years.
Yeah, and I think that you're always really flattered when somebody says, oh, I remember your commentary on this game, and they can recite the line better than you can. Uh-huh. Because as a commentator, you're not consciously thinking of, you know, shoehorning a line in here or there. You're, as I said, you're going with events. You might have in your mind something before the game. I mean, I remember before the when we did Hearts and Hibs a couple of years ago, when it looked as though Hearts were going to get relegated on that day in an Edinburgh derby. Mm-hmm. And I remember at halftime looking to Gary McAllister, my co-commentator, and just saying to him, Hearts are really playing well here, and they're so fired up, and it's almost as though they're saying, not on this patch of Edinburgh land, we're not. So I thought, not on this. Something stuck in my mind, and it came out as, when they got the second goal that made it sure they were not going to be relegated by Hibs on that day, it came out as, not on this patch of Edinburgh land, not in a derby, no relegation today. Now, I said it with more emphasis than now, but again, a lot of Hearts fans will say to me, that really, really encapsulated for me what we were thinking on that day. And I think if you can go halfway towards doing that, you don't always succeed, you don't always get it 100% right, but you do your best to try to be in that moment and to try to reflect that moment.
Which was one of the questions, and obviously we discussed your notes earlier. Some of these landmark lines that commentators like yourself and others have come out with, is there a way of pre-preparing for that? Because it must be difficult to try and encapsulate that moment. I suppose it's part of the art of commentary, when something momentous happens, to say something that's not banal or inappropriate.
Well, I don't think you can ever really pre-prepare a line, unless you're a very, very good actor. I think it's difficult to say, here's a pre-prepared line, I'm going to work that in. I think what you do is you prepare for the game. For example, last night, I was thinking a lot about Jo Inge Berget and the possibility of him coming back to to play a part in this drama, having been at Celtic and, let's face it, being a bit of a flop at Celtic.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was thinking, OK, who does this remind me of? It reminds me of Harold Brattbach a little bit. So I did use that at one point in commentary. Mm-hmm. And that came through, you know, preparation and scribbling things down and doing a bit of research and remembering the game when Brattbach scored twice for Rosenborg, having left Celtic, I think, about 18 months, maybe just under 2 years prior to that. So, and I was joking with Chris Sutton and John Hartson in our little truck before the game, saying, you know, he's nailed on to score here, you know that, Berger. And they sort of chuckled at me, but you know, these things do happen
they
in football, you know, with great regularity. So you prepare for these things, and through the preparation, maybe there is clarity in the line that you ultimately come up with, because you have thought about every angle. Hopefully you've thought about every angle. So that's where I think it comes from. But the job is to be able to, as I said before, react to events. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting, you know, one of the great commentators, the late Brian Moore on ITV, who you remember, and I certainly remember growing up, was a great all-round broadcaster. Remember in his memoirs, in his autobiography, he said, it's a funny thing as a commentator, some nights the words flow absolutely perfectly. Other nights you have to work, like a player, like anybody in a job. Other nights you have to work a bit harder because they don't flow quite as effortlessly. So, you know, you go with that flow and you recognize it yourself, probably like a golfer. You know, some days everything is straight down the middle and it's, you know, hitting the sweet spot all the time. Other days the swing's a little bit, just a little bit off, and you have to sort of, you know, massage your way around a little bit. So it's reacting. That's what it is. But it's a wonderful job. I'm very lucky to do what I do.
I do wonder whether when you're in a big crowd with a fantastic atmosphere, your point there about having to work at it, whether the adrenaline within you of the event and the emotion of the crowd help you to just the words flow out with it. Maybe if it's a quieter game with less emotion, you have to work at it more. Do you think that's possibly the case?
I think that's true. And I think the louder the crowd, for example, last night I deliberately, when the teams came out, I decided that I wasn't going to do very much commentary. I was going to let the whole thing speak for itself. And I did that as well with the Champions League anthem. But the only problem last night was that the crowd was so loud that you could barely hear the Champions League anthem on the television. But that was the idea. And I think that it is always easier when you have a very loud crowd such as we had last night. You try to make it more sparse, because the game does speak for itself. And so the trick then is really to find words that go with the rise and flow of the game. Now, if you're doing a game with very few fans in attendance, I think you sometimes then feel you need to talk a bit more. Probably don't, because the one thing I've learned over the years is that fans will very rarely criticise a commentator for under-talking.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it's ever happened, actually. I don't remember anybody saying to me, oh, you didn't say enough.
Yeah.
But if you overdo it, you'll get people saying, ah, be quiet, you know, you're talking too much. I can see for myself what's going on. So it's trying to capture that balance, and it's a difficult thing to do. It's not possible to please everybody, but you do your best with it.
Well, one of the things you do get right in commentary is people's names, pronunciations. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe I'm a pedant also, but one of the things that really riles me is people having lots of variance on the pronunciation of somebody's name in the media. I don't mind fans, because you're reading it in the press and you're not quite sure. However, I've never understood why on the very first press conference of introducing a player, either the club themselves turn round and say, can I just to clarify, this is the pronunciation of his name, or the first journalist doesn't say, before we start, can you just clarify exactly how you pronounce your name? I don't know why that doesn't happen, but it's something that you do make an effort to make sure you get everybody's pronunciation right. And the thing on people who follow you on Twitter will know is, you even put on Twitter so that this is how his name's pronounced.
Yeah.
And I've checked with the player or the embassy
And I do it, to be honest with you, I do it mostly for broadcasting colleagues, because I hope, I know they're not all following me or hanging on my every word, but I hope somebody might read it and retweet it and pass it on to somebody else. I think it's really important because, you know, I was looking at it from this point of view. If we were footballers in a different country, and somebody, a commentator there, just made up the pronunciation of our last names,
yeah,
I think we'd get quite annoyed. We'd say, no, you're saying
it's
that completely
manners.
Wrong. It's bad manners,
yeah.
And it's it's not that difficult. It's not that difficult in most cases. And I always say, you know, a written journalist would never misspell the name of a player. So why is it okay for a broadcast journalist to mispronounce the name of a player? Words and sounds are our game. So we should get that right. And, you know, yeah, I probably sound like a stickler and you know, like a bore when I'm talking about things like that. But I think it is important. And I make it a point of always, when there's a new player arrived in Scottish football, I will always go to that player and say, introduce myself and say, can you just say your name for me so that I can be 100% sure that I've heard you say it, and I can go to other people and say, this is how he says it. Jason Denier is a good example of that. When he arrived at Celtic Park, I remember for the first couple of weeks he was getting called all sorts of things.
Yeah.
And I had actually, the other thing I do is I go online a lot now, and it's amazing how many clips you will pick up of that said player maybe 2 years before doing a little profile or an interview with the club he was at the time. Mm-hmm. And he'll say his name. You know, it'll start with, hello, I'm Jason Denier. I'm a defender from... So, you know, I knew it was Denier because I'd heard him say that. But I went to him and I said, Jason, Derek Ray, BT Sport, can you just confirm Denier? Yeah, Denier. Thank you. Great. You know, so it's done. But... I don't quite know. I think sometimes people just want to make it up, and I don't know why.
To me, it only comes across as laziness.
Yeah, well, it is. It is. I mean, that's exactly what it is. And I think that if we call ourselves professionals, then this is part of the job. I'm sorry, and I don't think it's acceptable to say, I'm just going to call him whatever I fancy, or that sounds better. No, you know, you call him what his name is.
Yeah.
Simple.
Respect, which you mentioned earlier. I mean, I'd picked up that you spoke German and other languages, but you've obviously mentioned Spanish and...
French was the second language I picked up. German's the one that really is my ultimate passion.
What did you do at university? Was it language related at university?
Well, it was German and international relations. Mm-hmm. So you can sort of take from that, you know, where my interests in life are a little bit. And the German was always there, you know, from a very young age. Again, I tie it back to that 74 World Cup, which was in West Germany. Mm-hmm. And that was where the interest began.
Well, the international relations bit as well, with West Germany getting beaten by East Germany on West German soil.
And I think that planted a seed with me. Yeah, because I ended up, before I went to university, I spent a couple of months, I worked as a postman to begin with, saved up all this money working as a postman in Aberdeen. And then I got this volunteer position working in a school which was right on the border. When I say right on the border, 10 yards away from the fence, and then you could see the watchtower another 20 yards behind. It was a little village, a place called Hönebach, which was right on the border of what is now Hessen and Thüringen, but what then was East and West Germany, West and East Germany. And so that was absolutely fascinating. And it's something that I still, you know, I'm blessed to cover German football for BT Sport. It's the other thing that I'm extremely passionate about, and that'll never go away.
So do you think those language skills have also helped you develop your commentary skills of words flowing and just having a love of language in general?
Yes, I think I would have to think that's the case. I found that the better my German got when I was younger, the more fluent I became speaking English.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully I was always somewhat fluent, but I think it does help, because I think that, you know, they say that languages are a great thing in later life for somebody too, that they really do help the memory, they help on all levels. And I can see why, because to properly master a language, you do have to, you can't just sort of go into it and say, right, I'm going to do it 10 minutes a day and it'll be fine. If you really are serious about being fluent in a language, you know, there's a lot of sacrifice that has to go on, and there's a lot of immersing. And so probably the two went hand in hand. I probably didn't know it at the time. I was quite obsessed with German language, but I was also obsessed with the idea of being a football commentator. Mm-hmm. And I did see them as slightly separate skills, but then, of course, they would come together. And I realised that they did have a lot in common when on big European nights, when I was a 15, 16-year-old, instead of tuning into Radio Scotland, which I would, you know, do happily, or Radio 2 at the time, I would switch on WDR from Cologne in Germany and listen to the German coverage of the UEFA Cup or the European Cup and hear all the commentaries on the Cologne games and on the other German teams at the time. So it does open a wonderful world. I would always say to somebody, if you have any interest in a language at all, really go for it, because I know it's more difficult now with the internet and with English, you know, becoming the de facto world language. Back then it wasn't so much. I mean, it was going that way, but you know, you'd go to Germany and not everybody would speak English. Nowadays, most do.
Yeah.
But if you really do, you know, have an aptitude for language, if you find it something that floats your boat, then go for it. Put your heart and soul into it.
Now, you mentioned Istanbul and you and following Aberdeen in European competition, and your career has spanned quite an amazing time of evolution of the world becoming smaller. You mentioned again about the English becoming the world's first language, and this is I love the future. I'm not one for reminiscing. How I don't mind talking about the past, but not wallowing in the past. However, there is one small part to me about commentary about games. The 74 World Cup seemed very far away.
Yep.
The commentary was on a crackly line over you know, a different, you'll know the technology better than me, but my understanding of it was probably on a different line to the TV picture broadcast at the time. Everything seemed so far away. And now it's changed and everything's a bit nearer, but it's still a big wrench to move far away. And you were BBC Radio Scotland. You were, not going to sound patronising, no doubt you were in with the bricks. Why did you leave?
Not quite sure. It's the honest answer. I do wrestle with that now and again. I think it came down to, it was 1991. I had done the World Cup in 1990 in Italy. Thoroughly enjoyed it. I'd loved the whole aspect of, you know, meeting other journalists, other commentators from other countries, just being around, you know, that big football party for 5 weeks. I had spent 5 years at that point at BBC Scotland, and I had been to 19 different countries to cover games. I had got a taste of television, a little bit of TV experience. But I think I probably thought, and I was, 24 at the time, I probably thought, you know, I'm restless here and I would like to try something else. It's a bit mad when you think about it, because there was so much more to achieve. And the logical move for me, that a lot of people said the logical move, was to go to London and work for BBC Network, which would have been an option, because I had done the World Cup in 1990. I know the network people in London were happy with the work I had done. But there's part of me that's always been a little bit left field, a little bit, you know, let's not just do what everybody else does, let's carve out your own path. You know, as I say, hospital radio when I was a youngster, making tapes to myself, joining the BBC at 19. So, you know, I've always been a little bit independent that way.
Yeah.
And I think I thought, well, no, the London thing, everybody does that. You know, that's the path for just about everybody. I'd like to try, you know, something different. I'd become fascinated with the USA over 2 or 3 years. I'd been there, been to Boston in particular, where I'd established some contacts. And then during the 1990 World Cup, I met some of the people who were responsible for the 1994 World Cup, which was in the USA, and got on really well, kept in touch. And on a whim in 1991, I decided I was moving to Boston. So I did, and I enrolled in this course at a college in Boston, essentially because I was interested in how they broadcast and what the differences were. So I thought, okay, I'm going to give myself a few months. I'm going to just study here. I'm going to just be an observer for a little while and see what I make of this. And did little bits and bobs of freelance work. And
sorry to interrupt, was this a complete break from the BBC? Were you going there thinking, well, at least I've got the safety net that I can probably go back, or was it a complete...
Well, there was no real safety net. I mean, there were, you know, there were words exchanged. Yeah, you know, maybe you could come back, but it was never really in my mind to come back. I think I thought I had closed the book. I think I thought I've done this. You know, I'm ready for something else. I probably wasn't exactly sure what that was, but I knew that I wanted to try out the USA and see what it was that was different. I mean, this huge country, English-speaking country, but so many cultures together, hadn't really embraced the sport of football at that time. That interested me, the fact the World Cup was going there. So I think there was part of me that was restless, but part of me was thinking, I want to be in the USA before that World Cup in 94. So maybe I'm a lucky person, I don't know, but the people who were running the World Cup. Again, I met them when I was out in Boston, and it turned out they were looking for somebody to run their media operation in Boston. And the USA were about to play England in a high-profile game in 1992. So that really was the job I had to begin with. Sorry, 93.
93. The year before when they prepped for the
World Cup. That's right, 1993. So I'd done all this studying out there, some bits of freelance work, and then I got the gig as the media officer for the Boston venue for the US Cup 93 and World Cup 94, but obviously there was a bit of preparatory lead time on that. And I learned so much during that period. I learned about US media and how they operate, what makes them tick, totally different in terms of how they go about their business in comparison with the UK. I learned about being, I'm not going to say a PR man, because I was never really a PR man. The job was more of an operations job. But I learned about that sort of thing, different skill set. Made some contacts with FIFA, and I know that's a dirty word to some people nowadays, but what I always say about FIFA is there's some very good people in FIFA who've worked for years in the offices and doing the day-to-day stuff. People always focus on the president. But the 95% of the people I've dealt with at FIFA are good people who love the football, and that's the job that they've always had. So that was 93. 94 was then the build-up to the World Cup as the press officer for Boston. And I like to think I did a good job on that. And I ended up actually being transferred out to LA after Boston was finished as a venue to work at the final as well. So I've got great memories of that whole time.
Quite an interesting thing, because your whole point of football was not a big sport. Mm. So obviously media coverage, radio, TV, whatever, broadcasting of football would have been even lesser of a sport. So your skill set in media broadcasting was much more advanced, I would imagine, than your American colleagues. But the opposite then is the Americans being at that stage much further ahead in their broadcast media of all sports.
Well, I think maybe that's why they were attracted to me. I think they thought, okay, we think we know about sports PR and sports operations, which they do. And they were light years ahead of what we were doing in the UK at the time. What they didn't have was the football knowledge. And I think what they liked about me was, obviously, I'd come from a media background in Scotland, in a football country. I spoke a couple of languages, which was a big plus. Mm-hmm. And I think they thought that I was quite a good face for advice for what they were looking for. But it really did, I think about those, it really ended up being sort of 2.5 years altogether. When I think back to those 2.5 years, that they were magnificent years, because they challenged me in a different way. And it enabled me to learn all about America. I also met my wife during that period. Yeah. I'm still married to Beth, and we met in Boston all those years ago, in my early years at the World Cup. And so it's, a special time. And I was sad when the World Cup was over. I didn't quite know what was going to happen next, but ESPN then came on the scene in the football world. ESPN, who were already, the big names in sports broadcasting in the States, they decided they were going to start an international football broadcasting service. They'd actually started it around 92, 93, and they'd asked about my availability. They'd heard that there was this commentator who was living not too far away, who was working for the World Cup organising committee. I couldn't really commit to doing anything for them because I was so busy with the World Cup job. But after the World Cup, we got together and they had me down and started doing some games for them. And, that was the start of another really great relationship that lasted, I think how many years it was, probably 15, 16. Well, it's actually still ongoing because I still do things for them at major tournaments.
Was it easy, talking earlier about the language flows, was it easy to flip in, to change into using Americanisms for certain aspects of covering sport? Or was that a real conscious effort you had to do? I'm thinking the most obvious thing, referring it to as soccer instead of football.
Yeah. Well, I mean, for me, I went through a period of uncertainty in those early ESPN years because there was a senior producer told me that a British accent was not going to get gigs on a major network there, that the style had to be more American. So I went that way for a few years of Americanizing the style. But I'll tell you what happened. A few years after that, ESPN got rights to Scottish football. So all of a sudden, sitting in a studio on a Saturday morning, broadcasting to Australia and Africa, doing Scottish games, and a switch sort of was flicked in my mind. I can't broadcast games from Dunfermline using American technology. You know, it just doesn't work. And I think it's the best thing that ever happened, because I took a bit of a risk by doing that, because things have changed in the States. Now the British voice is very much in vogue. It wasn't back then. People saw this as a sport that was for people who are not Americans, let's just say. And so they wanted to Americanize the style. They wanted to make it mainstream. Thankfully, they've now, I think, got to the point where they say, let's have the best commentator. We don't care where he's from. Let's have the best commentator on the game. But that was an interesting period between about, you know, 95, 96, 97. MLS started, did games for the New England Revolution, the Boston team. They weren't very good in those days. They were the worst team in the league, just about. And I was having to put a very brave face on it, and it was difficult. And I think that, you know, that was hard as a commentator, because, you know, you weren't always being 100% honest about what was actually happening on the pitch. And I don't know that people wanted you to be 100% honest either, because you're broadcasting for the team.
Yeah.
But I learned a lot during that period, and I maybe in the end went a little bit too negative on MLS, but I think it helped me in the grand scheme of things, because it's made me think a lot more since then about positivity and negativity. And I'm a great believer that it's far easier to be negative. But if in doubt, you should always be positive about something that you love. And let's face it, as football fans, we all love the sport. You know, that's we don't watch games, hopefully, because we like to be negative about them. I think it would be strange if that were the case. But there is a negative streak in the football fan. And I have to say, here in Scotland, sometimes even more so. But I've always, since that period in the 90s, when I was maybe a bit negative myself about MLS, I've tried to take a long, hard look at what I was doing back then, thinking to myself, well, I can learn from that. And since I came back here a few years ago, I've you know, gone in with the idea that it's far better. I think people like you far more to be positive.
It's a difficult balance, because you don't want to be criticised as not stating the obvious.
Correct.
You know, for example, if we talk about Scottish football, I may sound as though I'm being critical when I say it's ridiculous, the performance of Scottish teams, excluding Celtic, in Europe for the last 20 years. But that's not because I'm wanting to be critical. It's because we should be doing better. So if we use Malmo beating Hibs 9-0 on aggregate, Malmo are not 9-0 better than Hibs. For me, that's part of the negativity that surrounds Scottish football, that we've actually persuaded ourselves that we are rubbish in Europe. And part of the reason we perform badly in Europe is because we believe we're rubbish in Europe. And so that negativity, so there's two ways to be negative. You can't ignore the fact that we're performing poorly in Europe, but it's about because you think we are better. So it is a difficult balance.
No, it is. It is. But I think that, you know, if in doubt, I go into a game thinking, if in doubt, I'm going to extol the virtues of something good rather than just saying that was terrible and that was rubbish. And I think, by and large, I think that is what people prefer.
Well, as Herrera once said, the perfect football game would finish 0-0 because nobody would make a mistake.
That's right. So,
football, in order for goals to be scored, have to make mistakes. And conscious of your time, so there's no other things I'd like to ask. I'm a big boxing fan. So from the, I remember getting the Ring magazine from about 1985, and you became conscious of how the American TV world was on a different planet to us, particularly when I'm paying attention from the mid 80s when you get into UK broadcasting. So you leave UK broadcasting with two cameras at a game and go to American broadcasting with their way. What were the good things that helped you develop as a commentator about the way that they covered sport? Have we adopted all of those things? Is there anything that we can still learn from American coverage of football and all sport? What would you say? And were there any things that you're glad that we've not adopted about the way they cover it?
Good question. I think as a broadcaster, I'll tell you what really helped me working in the States. When you commentate on a game there on television, you don't just do the commentary. You're the presenter, you're the interviewer, you're the the half-time man, you do everything. Mm-hmm. And up until that point, I hadn't really had too much experience of being in vision, as we say in the business. I'd been a commentator, been a reporter, but there's a certain skill in knowing how to look at a camera, mm-hmm. knowing how to do all that sort of stuff. And through working in the States, I did all the pre-match and everything, but then worked my way into presenting a daily show. Used to do a show every day that was a football discussion mm-hmm. program with a couple of other pundits, went around the world, and it developed quite the following. And through doing that and through having that opportunity, it made me a better broadcaster. I'm not sure in the UK I would have had that same chance, because people tend to be much more pigeonholed here. Yeah. If you think about it, most of the commentators whose voices you hear are rarely seen mm-hmm. nowadays. It was different back in the old days of Arthur Montford and Archie McPherson, yeah. Brian Moore. People like that would be jacks of all trades. They would do everything. So that is something I'm very grateful for. I think that it's always a balance. I think you learn, you know, from different cultures. I used to learn a lot listening to the German commentators, just with their emphasis and use of language. I think we generally do football better in this country. Mm-hmm. I think that comes down to being match fit over a number of years, having done it for so long. But I think the coverage in the US is improving. If you watch any MLS games nowadays, the TV coverage is very good. It's very well done. When I was working on it in the 1990s, it was still in its fledgling period. So you had a lot of directors and camera people who would come in from other sports. They would do soccer, as they called it, you know, one day out of 14, and then they go back to doing baseball and the other sports again. And they were always keen to learn. I remember having a conversation with one cameraman in particular who lived quite near me in Massachusetts, and he just was desperate to crack it, and he was always trying to pick my brain. He said, you know, what should I be looking for? What should I be, you know, what's the difference here? Yeah. And you know, he became very good at it. But it's just little things like in those days, you know, corner kick would come over, number 5 would head the ball, it would go just over the bar, and you'd get a close-up shot of number 10, you know, and I would point out, you know, that's not really great, you know. Yeah. if number 5 is headed the ball, I'm probably going to have a line to say about number 5, and if you show me a different player, it doesn't really make any sense. And I think it just took them a while to get that. But there are some very good directors and producers. Amy Rosenfeld, who I worked with in the early days at New England, she's now the lead executive producer on soccer coverage for ESPN, and she's an example of somebody who lives and breathes the game. So it's really just about finding a balance, and I think we can always learn from each other.
Yeah. So, which on that, and I'm conscious of time. You talked there about how good it was in America and living in Boston, and your wife, meeting your wife there.
Yep.
So to reverse the last question asked, why did you come back?
Well, I'll tell you what happened. The Champions League was the main draw, and it was, you know, very special to me, and it means a lot when I hear people, you know, the younger Americans, maybe in their mid-20s now, who tell me that they really got their first start as viewers watching the Champions League with my commentary. And it was always on during the afternoon Eastern time mm-hmm. in the States, or people would come home early from school or college or whatever. So this was the main thing for me as a commentator, was the Champions League. Got to do all the finals, all the big games. You know, it was a wonderful period, and it was a very high standard of competition at that time. But then, bombshell, 2009, ESPN lose the rights to Fox. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering, what am I going to do next? Could have stayed at ESPN. There would have still been hosting work to do, a lot of other commentary work. But I'd lost the big tournament for me. Now, I had been thinking for a number of years that I had unfinished business back in the UK, for want of a better way to put it. I'd left so young, as we touched on earlier. There were just things that I thought that I would like to go back and do. And it was something I'd been thinking about for a couple of years. I'd come back to the UK, I'd met a few TV people who I knew, and others who I didn't but got to know. And, you know, the advice was, no, your work is really, you know, we like your work. If you were in this market, we'd have no hesitation in using you. But it's finding the right opportunity, because you can come back as a freelance, but that doesn't always pay the bills. Mm-hmm. So you've got to come back in the right, under the right circumstances. So in that summer, everything happened in a hurry. We were actually on holiday. Beth and I were on holiday in Aberdeenshire. And it was like a sort of domino effect. ESPN lose the rights to the Champions League. around that same time, Setanta hit financial trouble.
Yep.
All of a sudden, ESPN move in, and they pick up Setanta's rights to the Premier League in England. While they're at it, they go in and get the Scottish rights as well, as part of a joint deal with Sky at the time. So a couple of phone calls were made, and the gist of it was, are you interested in moving back to the UK to commentate on Scottish football? And without hesitation, I said, yes, absolutely. It'd been something I had been thinking about. I was conscious of the fact that I'd been away a long time. I was probably unknown to a lot of people. You know, who's this? Who's this guy who's coming from America? What's he all about? Exactly, yeah. But I really wanted to, I think, prove to my home audience, because this is always my home audience. Yeah. This is always going to be the most important audience to me, the Scottish audience, and it was while I was in the States as well, when I was doing these Champions League games to people all around the world. I was very conscious of the fact that I was a Scot and that it meant an awful lot to cover Scottish teams above all else. But I wanted to demonstrate that that I was up to the task, and hopefully, you know, people think that I was. That was 2009. That first season was amazing because I was still doing my job in the States. I was flying back and forth.
That's
everywhere.
What I was going to ask you. You were flying back and forth in the first year.
I was doing two jobs, and I was that was the deal.
Some decent emails.
I did. Yeah, I think I've used them all since then, sadly. But that was the agreement, that I would still do one or two things out of the States. So the routine was, I'd fly on a Thursday through the night. I'd get into Glasgow usually on a Friday. Sort of mid-morning, I'd sleep for a couple of hours, finish my prep, game on Saturday, fly back to London a lot of the time Saturday night, and then fly to the States Sunday. And then the first time I remember doing it on the Sunday, I ambitiously went straight on the air and presented a programme on the Sunday night. And in the second commercial break, I think I was caught with my eyes completely closed. So I think we realised that we had to sort of be careful with the scheduling. Yeah. And then at the end of that first year, things had gone well over here. And, you know, I think we looked at each other and said, you know, I think it probably has to be a permanent move. And obviously, you know, my wife had to be on side with that as well. And she was brilliant about that. And here we are several years later. ESPN obviously wasn't meant to be UK-wise after a few years.
Which surprises me, a company this backed by Disney, who is the sports broadcast in the United States, didn't decide to become the broadcaster in the UK.
Well, I think, you know, obviously I can't answer for ESPN, but I think that, you know, they're very conscious of business models, and I think the business model they were going for, you know, didn't necessarily add up, if you want to put it in those terms. I think it came down to losing the Premier League rights, you know, because that's very important for a sports broadcaster. And so they lost the Premier League rights and then made what they would see as a prudent decision to withdraw.
I suppose from BT's perspective, who then stepped in, there's other aspects than just the TV.
That's right, and BT's a British company and a successful British company, and again with a different business model. So probably difficult to compare and contrast on an even basis. But that's been more than 2 years now with BT Sport. It's been exciting.
And you've got your Champions League back.
We've got a Champions League back.
After losing your Champions League at ESPN, which prompted this whole move across, you've now got your Champions League back. So you must be chuffed a bit.
No, it's great. I mean, for me, you know, it's special. The Champions League is a special tournament, and it's my favourite tournament of all the competitions that we cover. And I go back a long way with it. And, you know, that's, I think, great as a commentator. You can draw upon things that you experience yourself. I covered so many Celtic matches over the years, most of them off tube from a studio in Connecticut.
Yeah.
But, you know, the Nakamura goal, I can still remember it like it was yesterday. Some of the big games involving my now co-commentator Chris Sutton and Henrik Larsson, you know, under the Martin O'Neill period. And so here we are. And now as we speak today, we're wondering if Celtic are going to be in the group stage. We'll find out in a few days' time.
We are. And one final thing before you have to go, because you're based in London.
I am.
So TV rights have become the big ticket in broadcasting. It's the only thing we now all watch live is sport. And obviously there's been the NBC big purchase of English Premiership rights across the United States on quite a long contract, which has surprised me with the evolution of how we consume media. Where do you see the consumption of media going for sports broadcasting? Can you forecast it?
I think it's very hard to forecast. What I will say is that it's constantly evolving. I don't know about you, but when I'm watching football now, I'm as likely to do it on my iPad as I am on television. In fact, that's my routine. I'm sitting, you know, doing my match sheets, and I might be using my iPhone to check a couple of things with the iPad on with a game on in the background. And I think that's probably true of a lot of people nowadays. So where it's going, it's anyone's guess. I think all we know for sure is that it will evolve. It's been funny for me looking back at some of the games from just 9-10 years ago to look at the difference in picture quality from then to now. We thought it was space age back then, but if you look at a game from a decade ago now, it looks like it's from the 1970s in comparison. So things are always changing. BT Sport are at the forefront of the ultra revolution with 4K, which is going to be the next big thing. I've had a chance to have a look at examples of that, and it's pretty amazing.
Which is the interesting thing, because at exactly the same time as we are having this enhanced quality, the competitor to BT Sport are those on the verge of legality, free streams of the likes of Cody, which can never succeed for me, because who's going to pay for the 22, 25, 30 cameras at the match?
Well, that, I always think people forget that. People always say, oh, streaming is the answer. I'm saying, yeah, well, who do you think's actually, who's supplying the facilities for these things, you know? And that is an important factor in all of this, that there is a considerable cost involved in, for example, last night putting together an OB unit to cover the game, not just for UK viewers, but for the whole world. And that's how it works. And I think people are a bit blasé about that sometimes.
Ultra conscious patching a taxi. So I have three very important questions. Normally two of them are up front, and one of them is a last one specific to you. So the two that are normally up front, but just the way the conversation has evolved. What was your first game and who was your first hero?
First game was Aberdeen against Dundee United around 1972. Mm-hmm. First hero was Drew Jarvie.
Drew Jarvie
at Aberdeen. I don't know what it was about Drew Jarvie, but he just seemed to be a really nice guy as well. He was part of the community, scored goals, he made goals, had a very distinctive appearance as well.
Footballers don't look like that anymore.
No, they don't. But Drew Jarvie was my first.
They look like old men. Footballers don't look like old men now. Whereas when we were growing up, there was guys in the park who looked like a 60-year-old man would look.
That's
today.
Right, exactly.
They would have a pot belly.
And be proud of it, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, not to down-talk a Lisbon Lion, one of my vaguest, earliest memories, I'm 3 years younger than you, one of my vaguest, earliest memories was Tommy Gemmell playing as a player-manager for Dundee.
Yeah.
And it may be in time my memory has exaggerated it, but his jersey didn't quite fit over his belly. He wouldn't get a professional on a football park at the top level.
Great days.
So the final question to allow you to not miss your plane, what would be your ultimate commentary game?
Ultimate commentary game. I think it would have to involve Scotland, and I think it would have to be, well, I would even, it wouldn't have to be a final, a major tournament. For me, it would be Scotland in a significant knockout stage game at a major tournament, because that's the one thing we've been starved of for years. Covered Scotland in the 1990 World Cup. 1998, I wasn't working for a British broadcaster, I was working for ESPN. So we haven't really had these big games involving our national team, and that's the thing I would be most happy to get the chance to commentate on. Were it against England in a big game, I think that would make it even more special. But I would take Scotland against anybody in a semi-final of a major tournament. See, I'm not even going to be as fussy as to say a final. I'll take a semi-final.
Okay, well, with that, and to allow you to catch your flight, I'll say, Derek Ray, thanks very much.
Absolute pleasure.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Cheers.
So I hope you enjoyed that podcast with Derek. I could have gone on and talked more about media comparisons in the United States to UK and where it would go and things like that. And also talked a lot more to him about his formative years as an Aberdeen fan. But time was against us, and we covered quite a bit in what we did. And maybe another day I'll get another chat with Derek. But it was a very nice morning to go over things following the Malmö game. Also like to remind everybody of the annual Paradise to Cardenden cycle, which is in memory of Celtic goalkeeper John Thompson. And the 2015 event is taking place on the anniversary of the Prince of Goalkeepers. So if you're interested in that, or the following day, there is the Jockstein 30th anniversary match and dinner between the legends of Celtic and Dunfermline, taking place at East End Park. Also, you don't have to do these formal things. You can do whatever you want and raise money for the Celtic FC Foundation. An example of how many people are doing that is the Great Scottish Run, which is taking place the weekend 3rd, 4th of October. If you're running in that, you can raise money for the Celtic FC Foundation. If you contact the foundation, they will assist you in how to do that. So if you want to get involved in any of these things, then you can email or telephone. So email is cfcfoundation@celticfc.co.uk. That's cfcfoundation@celticfc.co.uk, or telephone 0141 551 4291. However, it's time to get this podcast uploaded. So that's enough from me. This is me, Harry Brady, saying God bless and good night. Good night.